Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:38, and today is Friday. It's May 1st, and there's a good number of markets are closed, but of course it's being Friday and the end of April. It's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Well, if we kick off and just look at what happened this week, then there was a great deal of volatility, particularly in some of the stock markets, where you've had European shares pull back by over 2% and some even 3% in the middle of the week. They're closed today. They were a little bit firmer yesterday by and large, but this still looks like a process of mean reversion in Europe. Elsewhere in the equity markets, that the Chinese stock market has not looked back. It's going to be closed for a week now because of the Golden Week with because of Labor Day. And elsewhere in Asia, the Taiwanese market, having surged last week, was down a bit this week, and in particularly the banks are unwinding a short-term overbought condition. The Indian market continues in a process of mean reversion, and it's currently trading below the 200-day moving average for the first time in well over a year, and there isn't a great deal of evidence just yet that it has found support in that area. When we go and look at Wall Street, then the Russell 2000 pulled right back to test the region of the moving average and the upper side of the underlying range, and it firmed a little bit in here today. Not really in a dynamic fashion, but at least it's firming at the first area of potential support. And Wall Street was generally firm. The majority of indices were up 1% and some a little bit more than that. And that almost completely countermands yesterday's downward dynamics. What we continue to see is that the number of times that that Wall Street has fallen for three or four consecutive days in any kind of meaningful way is really quite small relative to the sort of ranging advance that we've had. Certainly, people are starting to look around and they're saying, well, the majority of shares in the US are at least fully valued and some are overvalued, that the opportunities for hard value fundamental investors have deteriorated. At least that's at least part of the reason that the private equity firms were able to raise such huge amounts of capital in such short order when you had this big pullback in energy shares, because the opportunities that exist for value-oriented investors are reasonably thin on the ground, so a lot of money poured in there. Whether that was in fact the best idea is really open to question here, and it will be answered, I suspect, in the next 3 or 4 months when we see just how much of a rally oil is likely to have. It was a little bit weaker in here today, but not in any kind of dynamic way. Only about between 25 and 39 cents between down on the day between Brent and WTI. When we go and then look at the currency markets, then the US dollar was probably the strongest currency in the world in the first quarter of the year, and spent the last month unwinding that short-term overbought condition. And it is interesting now that particularly among the currencies where it had weakened the most and unwound that deep overbought condition, that it is now again finding support. I've posted a number of charts in here today, not least, say, the Singapore dollar, where the US dollar had broken out and then pulled back really quite sharply over the last month to unwind that overbought condition, and it bounced again in here today. Well, this is exactly the kind of area you'd expect it to find support. So while the vast majority of people would be looking at the euro-dollar rate, what we're also seeing is that the yen is weakening. It's back up now to, well, the dollar is back up to 120. And in the absence of a downward dynamic, you'd be thinking that the chances are it is going to break out. Much of the yen's oversold condition has now been unwound, and the potential for additional downside, considering that the Bank of Japan is still printing at really quite an impressive pace, is you'd have to think that it would be more likely than not. One of the things that is quite interesting is that industrial metals have had a bounce, and not least copper. where it was up by about 8 cents yesterday and 4 cents today. That's taking the price on the COMEX contract up to 293. Well, $3 represents the lower side of the overhead trading range. And a sustained move above $3 would begin to reassert demand dominance beyond the very short term. What you do have there is commonality, that if you look at, for example, the tin market, that tin had pulled back really incredibly sharply, but has been bouncing and, you know, has unwound at least the, perhaps not all the way back up to the 200-day moving average, but it's now testing the progression of lower rally highs that's been in evidence for the last 9 months. And the nickel market is also firming up. Well, one of the things that we'd be looking at, that we tend to think about cycles, that it is these old world and generally beaten down sectors that tend to outperform in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market. There hasn't really been any evidence of that for the last couple of years. Even when I was doing the chart seminar a couple of weeks ago in Singapore, then we looked at the FTSE 350 mining index, which contains most of the big miners, and looking at it relative to the FTSE 350, and there was no real evidence that it was outperforming. That's beginning to change. That it's something that we're looking at, because there practically hasn't been a major medium-term bull market where you didn't see a fairly substantial rally in resources shares in the latter stages. So we've been looking for that as an indication that we were beginning to get into that type of phase. There hasn't been any evidence of it over the last year, but certainly what we are seeing now is that the mining sector has found at least short-term support in absolute terms and in relative terms. It hasn't quite broken the downtrend just yet. But when you start to click through that sector, then the big established companies like BHP and Rio have at least steadied, and then they're being supported by what are still competitive yields. Then if you look a little bit further down the line, you look at Anglo American, which fell from about 3,500 P to 1,000 P and is finding support. That Glencore, which is probably one of the better managed companies, particularly from a trader's perspective, but that is also looking now that it's going to break this progression of lower rally highs. Well, we're beginning then to see evidence that the resources sector is beginning, at least in the early stages, of turning the corner. And this is after really quite an accelerated decline, where the vast majority of people have become totally disillusioned with the sector. And that's exactly what one would expect in terms of the underperformance relative to some incredibly high-flying sectors. So that's, I think, certainly something to bear in mind. And even if one isn't interested in investing or participating in the potential for a catch-up play, not least because we don't have conclusive evidence yet that it has started, but it is worth monitoring for the simple reason that it is the sector that generally tends to rally last, and it will often rally for longer than the wider market. Well, it also means that we could have it's often a lead indicator by a year. So there isn't any real panic here. But certainly that you're seeing these industrial metals moving to outperformance is important. Well, of course, then let's think about where we are in terms of the overall cycle. Well, Wall Street ranged between 1999 and 2013 before breaking out. At the chart seminar, what we have said for decades is that a lengthy range is, and any range is, an explosion waiting to happen. Well, we've had the explosive breakout, and that breakout is still going. There isn't any evidence that that breakout has ended. We won't have evidence that that breakout is beginning to roll over into a consolidation of those gains until the progression of higher reaction lows has been broken and the indices start to encounter resistance in the region of their 200-day moving averages. There isn't any major stock market has done that. So in terms of the medium-term bull market, then we're still very much in action. Now, where are we then in terms of the very big picture? Well, if you're thinking in terms of the context of that almost, well, 13-year range on Wall Street, 15-year range on the FTSE 100, 15-year range for indices like the DAX, or sectors like the DAX, then you'd have to think that we're in the foothills of a secular bull market. But at the chart seminar, when I posed, we talk about the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets in the morning on the second day. And I asked the question, well, where do you think we are now? And the vast majority of people said that we were in this third psychological perception stage, which would be associated with the beginning of a bubble. Well, then that's a great example of just the fractal nature of markets, that we are at a stage now where people are generally getting kind of afraid about what the prospects are, but then you have central banks that are still printing. Well, how much money is there out there? It's approximately $15 trillion. If you take the balance sheets of the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and China, rebase the whole lot to dollars and add them up, you come up with about $15 trillion, and that number is still rising. It went sideways for about 18 months because while the Bank of Japan was printing and the Fed was printing, the ECB withdrew $1 trillion from its balance sheet, and now, since March, it is putting it back in. Well, the euro might have gone down a lot, but €1 trillion is still a lot of money. The Bank of Japan is still printing. The trajectory on their balance sheet is practically a straight line, going up at about a 70-degree angle. So then there is no shortage of money. In fact, because energy prices and commodity prices have pulled back so much that they have initiated the deflationary fears. There was nobody was worried about deflation in 2008 when commodity prices were pulling back. Everyone was worried about inflation. Now that we've lived through deflation, people are terrified of deflation. But I think it is a misnomer to call this deflation, that this is more like disinflation. Commodity prices went up an awful lot, and now they've come back down. It also means that because these are reasonably temporary phenomenon and that commodity prices look like they're starting to find support, that these deflationary fears will wash out within 6 months, and you'll get a rebasing of the economic statistics. When we start to think about this longer term, then when you have a wall of liquidity hitting the market, then that is just wonderful, that inflating asset prices. And that inflation of asset prices is still underway. When you have this week that Apple has its results, and not only is it now the largest company in the world, but in terms of the dollar amount that it's going to pay out, in terms of its dividend, it's the largest dividend payer in the world, and it's going to buy back a large chunk of its shares. And yet the price pulled back sharply. Well, what we see is that it was bouncing a little bit in here today, and it's still a reasonably consistent trend, and we might see some additional consolidation, but that the shares of these very large companies are becoming collector's items. And that's one whole portion of the market where they are aggressively buying back their shares. Then, if you look at the other side of the market, there is an increasing pipeline of IPOs. The quality of these IPOs is really quite varied. Some are really fantastic companies and others just aren't. And there is a great deal of enthusiasm for social media, for biotech, and a number of IPOs within the energy sector. Some of these are going to do very well. But what it is a symptom of is that we have incredibly loose monetary policy. There is an enormous availability of funds, and it's inflated asset prices. And of course, the best time to sell your company is when you think you can get more for it than you believe it's worth. And right now, people are falling over themselves to IPO. Well, that has got to tell us that we're not particularly early within the medium-term cycle. What will tell us that we are late in the secular cycle is when all of these companies that have been reducing their free float and withdrawing supply from the market actually start to reissue their shares. And at the present moment, we are nowhere near that. It then goes to tell us that we might be early in the secular bull market, but we're probably getting into the latter stages of the medium-term bull market. And that means then that what are the prospects? Is there evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3? Well, for these major indices, they have not really accelerated. You might say that the European indices accelerated higher in nominal terms, and that was mostly because the euro had been going down so fast. But on a currency-adjusted basis, we haven't really seen markets accelerating higher. And what we're now looking at is China, which has had this incredible breakout, but then a breakout from a long range is what we expect to happen. Long range is an explosion waiting to happen. When the explosion happens, it takes everybody by surprise. They often go on for longer than anyone had ever anticipated and go further than people had believed possible. That has certainly been the case for China. I would say that the odds are, I would probably stacked in favor of a consolidation after the New Year holiday. And that won't be, we won't see that or evidence of that until after next week. The Chinese market will be closed for the full week. I think Hong Kong will only be closed for a day or two. Well, a lot of people now are calling bubble. People don't generally tend to call a bubble when they're fully invested. When a market has been rallying for years and then accelerates higher, people are just generally overcome with euphoria because they're long and making money faster than they thought possible. But when they are underpositioned or have no position at all and they see a big breakout and it's the highest price that someone's seen in the last 5 years and market has gone up 50% in the space of a very short period of time, then people think it's too late and call it a bubble. Therefore, it really is worth taking the time and having the perspective and avoiding the myopia and looking at long-term charts, because it would be a misnomer to call something that has broken out in the last 3 months a bubble when there are other markets, not least bonds, that have been rallying for 30 years and people don't consider those a bubble. When we then go back and think, what are the, is there evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3? Well, type 1 is acceleration, and we haven't had the acceleration. We've certainly had a little bit of a loss of momentum, but nothing in the way of the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. If we were to see that on Wall Street, then it would probably result in a medium-term period of consolidation and correction. The fact that you have seen this massive breakout suggests that when that eventually does happen, then there could be a lengthy period of consolidation, and that would probably happen above the underlying range. But for the S&P, which is currently around 2150, then the upper side of the underlying range is closer to 1600, and that's an awfully large range. We don't have evidence yet of a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and we don't have the incredible volatility of a Type 3 top either. What we are presented with is this progression of higher reaction lows and a rhythm where the market has continued to find support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And until that changes, we have to continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. What people are worried about, I think perhaps most right now, is the possibility that the Fed is going to raise rates at some point this year. They probably believe that they have to do that. Well, considering that we haven't seen an interest rate hike in nearly 8 years, and the fact that wage pressures are now beginning to rise, then there is the possibility that the Fed will raise rates just to prove that they can. I think that it's very likely they will raise rates at some point this year, but that they'll probably wait and see what happens after they've raised rates once. That there's no need to think that they're going to raise rates every quarter, at least not at the beginning. What we definitely saw after the 2003 period was that they raised rates at every meeting by a quarter of a point. It was very rhythmic, and it took a while for the interest rate to go up enough to represent a headwind to the economy. We're still in this very benign environment. We definitely do not have an inverted yield curve. And what people are worried about is valuations. If we look then and think about the script, generally speaking, what you would get in a trend is that as it progresses, it should get more consistent. If it's getting more consistent, it means that the difference or the gap, the imbalance between supply and demand is getting wider, that demand is becoming progressively more dominant. To a greater or lesser extent, that is exactly what we've seen on Wall Street, that we had these incredibly volatile ranges in 2010, 2011, and then things got progressively more consistent from about 2012 onwards. If that's the case, then if the trend gets progressively more consistent from here, then it could accelerate higher, considering that we still have this incredible amount of liquidity. And I think perhaps the most important consideration is that due to globalization, due to global capital markets, capital is both global and mobile. That if the Fed printing was contributed to bull markets elsewhere, then printing elsewhere, such as in Europe and Japan and China and just about everywhere else, can contribute to bull markets in the rest of the world and not least on Wall Street. Perhaps the most important factor is that the dollar has bottomed. And this is both an opportunity and a challenge. But what the ramifications are is that we're going to have a great deal more volatility in currency markets. And we've seen a taster of that over the last 6 months. This has been not especially difficult to predict once the Japanese started devaluing their currency. Because the dollar was so weak for so long, there was the perceived wisdom, because people had experience, and people don't generally come to conclusions until they have evidence to support their view, that the dollar was going to go down forever. Well, that's just not the case. The dollar and the US economy have got some very compelling strengths, and not least relative to the rest of the world. So the prospect of the interest rate differentials starting to tighten up and then reverse is becoming much more of a convincing argument. We haven't really had interest rate differentials in favor of the USA for a very long time. And that then suggests that what we're seeing today is that the dollar is finding support in the region of the moving average against a basket of currencies. And that's what you'd expect in terms of the first big breakout from a very long trading range and a very long downtrend against some currencies. What it really means is then that dollar-dependent economies, and certainly those people that have been short dollars and been borrowing in US dollars, are going to be under pressure. That's certainly been the case for a good swathe of Latin America, where there has been an awful lot of dollar funding, not least because they thought that the commodity bull market would last forever and that their currencies were going to appreciate indefinitely. It's also probably the biggest potential headwind that a lot of Africa has. A lot of African countries have to issue their debt in US dollars, and the prospect of the dollar strengthening is really not particularly good news for them in terms of their debt financing. Then you probably have to bet on the countries that have got the ability to issue debt in their own currencies, like Uganda and Tanzania, relative to perhaps Kenya or Ethiopia.
what they then need to do is respond and continue to aggressively tackle governance. We've plenty of evidence that governance is improving right across Africa. And if we're going to, well, I guess veteran subscribers will be familiar with our view that the global middle class is going to expand for over the next 20 years. There's pretty good evidence for that, that we're going to have an additional 2 billion people. But perhaps the most important factor is that those 2 billion additional people, a good portion of them are going to be in Africa, that the birth rate has already peaked in India, that the Chinese population is has already peaked. So if those people are going to reach their productive capacity, and because of technological innovation and not least the availability of that technology, there's an increasing possibility that they will reach their productive capacity, then the next couple of decades could be very exciting for a number of countries within Africa. But that is going to be subject to governance. And these are developing markets for the autonomies, where you already see that a number of autonomies have got listings within Africa. But that's not nearly as important as the fact that these are developing markets with the potential for middle class growth and literally billions of people. So it's very important what happens in Africa, and not least because of that governance. And we can see particularly in the world today where you have just strife in areas of the world where governance has never really improved and declined, like in Ukraine or in the Middle East, and where you have governance improving across the vast majority of Asia and in large parts of Africa, and they're reaping the benefits as a result. When we think about where technology is going, then I mean, news today that they have achieved artificial photosynthesis is, I just find it incredibly encouraging, inspiring, that we're in this age of accelerating technological innovation. The fact that they can replicate photosynthesis is, I don't think that you can be too enthusiastic about the potential ramifications of that. That this is talking about creating energy, creating carbohydrates, if one wants to be absolutely accurate, but without the use of electricity, using a chemical procedure. It could potentially be absolutely revolutionary for the chemical and solar sectors. And with today's release, or I guess the launch, a high-profile launch of Tesla's home battery, the Powerwall, I thought that it would be interesting to review the industrial applications of these batteries, and there are a number of companies already doing it. It still, I think, could only be described as a developmental sector, but one that is going to develop because of the ability of batteries and energy storage facilities to smooth out the supply and demand profile of the electricity markets over the medium term. Well, when we then start to think about what are the constituents for that we need to have in place for a secular bull market, everyone tends to be myopic, and we're worried about the short term and the potential of whether we're going to see a pullback or we're going to see the major indices accelerate higher from here. But even if they were to accelerate higher from here and then potentially pull back, that would only be a portion of what has the potential to be a bull market that can persist for the next 20 years. That if you look over the last 100 years, we get big move and a range, and a big move to the upside and a range, and these big moves have generally taken approximately 20 years. Well, if we had the breakout 2 years ago, then there's no bull market goes up in a straight line. We do get medium-term pullbacks in the context of any secular bull market. We will get a medium-term pullback and consolidation in this one. Right now, there's no evidence of it. What are the things that will be important in terms of the secular bull market over the next 20 years? Well, Population is certainly one of them, and the availability of people to reach their productive capacity, not least in the world's major population centers. The fact that you have technological innovation is even more important because it's a facilitator. If you have governance as your base and improving governance as your base, then the availability and the availability of technology and the fact that the technological tools that are available to us are improving all the time gives the potential for people to reach their productive capacity in a much shorter period of time. So we have biotechnology, we have 3D printing. The 3D printing sector is improving at such an incredible rate that the main companies that had consolidated the industry are being really wiped away by the innovation that is already happening that they don't happen to own. With photosynthesis being able to synthesize it, and obviously that's only in the lab and it's going to take years to make it commercial, there is also the potential that the existing solar technology is just going to get wiped away by what is coming down the line, that it is only a matter of time before we get efficiency rates moving into a position, and we're not that far away from it, where solar technology becomes totally widespread. Well, it's at that stage then that people will have a home battery in their homes. That's probably also good news for home builders, because people are going to need bigger houses. If they're going to have all these solar cells on their roofs, and they're going to have batteries in their car, in their garages, and they're going to have their electric vehicle charging, well then, if you live in an apartment building, it's going to require some pretty expensive retrofitting to get all of that going. It would suggest that single family homes are going to become even more desirable. Well, when you also then start to think about all of the applications that we're getting in terms of computer technology, with the continued efficiency gains that we're getting in terms of the supply chain, with the evolution of quantum computing, with the evolution of really large data centers and just this big data drive. It's all well and good to talk about big data, but you couldn't have had big data until you had masses of digital data. So one feeds off the other. The more data that we have, the more efficient the big data logarithms are going to be. Well, all of this is contributing to the potential for productivity gain. And one of the enablers for all of this has been that the fact that people have been investing a great deal of money in alternatives because energy prices have been so high. Well, the fact that you had unconventional oil and gas coming through in the last 5 or 6 years, and well, that was a clear game changer for the energy sector, and that's now largely in the price. If you go to the chart library and type in OILPHIST and go for all data, and you can get that back to 1860 and put it on a log scale, what you see is very lengthy periods of consolidation that are followed by these incredible bull markets. Well, we've just had a bull market, and the chances are that oil prices are going to be ranging in a volatile manner for the foreseeable future. What it means is that we're not going to have the year-on-year advances in energy prices one year after the other, and energy price inflation that cripples the ability of people to think about using more energy and in an abundant fashion. Well, because the oil and gas, the unconventional oil and gas is already in the price, then people aren't really thinking about the potential for solar to be a total game changer. And that's looking to be just the base case scenario. We're just not there quite yet, but we're rapidly approaching that area where not really thinking about the potential for coal to supplant oil, or natural gas to supplant oil, or oil to supplant something else, but that the potential for solar energy to become totally ubiquitous and to just remove a substantial portion of demand for energy for fossil fuel is really looking to be much more of the most likely scenario that's unfolding. And what I notice is that when you read these energy reports from analysts, that they don't seem to consider that possibility at all. Well, what we'll see evidence of is that oil's rally will be capped. There isn't any great evidence that it is capped out just yet, and certainly the Baker Hughes rig count continues to fall. Well, we're not going to have a near-term peak in oil prices until the rig count starts to turn back upwards. So, well, that's released every day on a or every week on a Friday, and I generally tend to look at it at least that once that week. When we then think about the long term, that we have masses of new people that are reaching their productive capacity and can do so in an energy environment where the prices are coming down in conjunction with, or I guess in obedience to, Moore's law, then you have the possibility that productivity growth shoots upwards, and if you have productivity growth, you have a secular bull market. And we're still in the very early stages of that. When you think then about where does that take us in terms of the commodity price cycle, that during secular bull markets, commodities generally trend lower in real terms. What we, what we're now starting to see is that wages are starting to rise in the USA. That's generally an inflationary signal, and probably good news in terms of the debt cycle, that it will allow governments to inflate away their debt on an incremental fashion, but that bonds at the present moment are bubbly, and they're particularly bubbly for the simple reason that the people that are closest to the market don't realize that it's a bubble, that it's the minority view that bonds are in a bubble, but what we can say is that they are most definitely in a bubble, but that that bubble has yet to pop, that before the bubble pops, there will be any number of reasons for why people can't sell. And in the current environment, people can't sell because governments have engineered the market so that people simply cannot get out of them, or that they have to incur an expense in order to sell their positions, particularly in the insurance and pension sectors. Well, that will sustain it for a while longer, and money printing will sustain it, but when interest rates begin to rise, and if you have wage growth, particularly in the USA, then wages, or then interest rates will eventually have to rise, then that's going to result in a lot of leverage getting taken out of the bond markets, and it could potentially be really quite unruly. But the other way to think about it is that if you're in a secular bull market, where people are reaching their productive capacity and wages are increasing and more people are engaging in the global economy, well, then it's not appropriate for interest rates to be so incredibly low. And that we've been through this extraordinary period of time where interest rates have been incredibly low and we've been convalescing from a massive credit crunch. Well, some people say that that central banks will not be able to unwind this problem and that we're going to have an even bigger crunch later. They might yet be right, but we don't yet see any evidence of it. And the problem is that none of us know how this excess liquidity is eventually going to be unwound, because no one has ever seen anything like it before. What we have to do is simply monitor the chart and the price action. That will tell us what people are doing with their money. And what people are doing with their money then will feed a trend, and the trends tend to be self-fulfilling. So we don't have any evidence of this Armageddon scenario right now. If interest rates begin to rise and economies begin to recover and stock markets are doing well, then the need to hold an asset like gold, well, it becomes less convincing. And that generally would then mean that gold prices will come back to the marginal cost of production. But the interesting point is that we're probably not that far away from the marginal cost of production at the present moment, but that the fall in oil prices will have decreased that marginal cost of production. Provided gold prices can continue to range, then that's probably good news for the mining sector, that they've seen that their cost base has decreased and they're probably making more money from their mining operations, that they've stopped investing in new mines and paying silly prices to acquire other operations. So their balance sheets should start to improve and their cash flow should start to turn positive, so that there is the potential that, provided gold prices don't deteriorate in a big way, that the gold miners will start to outperform the gold price, and probably for the first time in the last 6 years. Well, you start to take it into account then that there is the possibility that the dollar is going to rally on a prolonged basis, that we're perhaps in the latter stages of a medium-term cyclical bull, but in the early stages of a long-term secular bull, that when you have big bull markets which are supported by some strong currencies, then generally you can get some really very big bull markets, and that there are good reasons to be bullish over the long term because of this just incredibly exciting stuff that's going on in technological innovation. At some stage, some of these shares that are listing at aggressive multiples and accelerating higher will roll over. And, well, we've seen a bit of that in the biotech sector of late, and Biogen is almost now right back to the region of its 200-day moving average. It will probably be a bellwether for that sector, whether it can find support at that level. But there's probably not a great deal to be worried about until we start to see liquidity getting drawn out. And we're probably not there just yet. I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.